give us your money, and we'll promise you the sky for it. But again, they control your money, and you do not. So the, another question is, you know, who is controlling your wealth, and in what form is it? So it's very important for, to think that way. And a lot of these things I do address in my paper too. So if you'd like my paper, just call 717-648-2682, and I'll send you a free copy of that 26-page paper on gold and the scams in the coin industry. And you can get a bit of an education on what to do, even if you don't want to buy any gold or silver. If you can't, I won't feel bad. Just so you get some information you can read.
All right, Cal. Well, thank you so much. It's been a pleasure having you on with us this evening. Good luck. Bye-bye.
Thank you, Stan.
Well, this is Dr. Stan back here at Radio Liberty, and this is the time when I need to remind our listeners that Radio Liberty is primarily listener-supported. And if you agree that there's a problem out there and you'd like to become a member of the Radio Liberty family of supporters and help us as we reach out across America 5 hours every day trying to warn people that we're in for some very difficult times. We're involved in a war in Iraq. And our boys are not coming home when this war is over. The plan was laid out long before the war to keep our troops permanently stationed in the Middle East. And if you doubt that, you need to go to their website. That's the Project for the New American Century, Project for the New American Century, and www.newamericancentury.org is their website, newamericancentury.org, and look up their Rebuilding America's Defenses plan. It was published in the year 2000, and they will tell you the plan is to leave our troops in the Middle East and throughout the world permanently stationed as the first defense against America. So we're going to have our troops not defending America. We're going to have our troops all across the world. And that's what it's all about. And there they talk about the necessity of keeping our troops permanently stationed in the Middle East. And they even talk about the need to have our troops there transcends the regime of Saddam Hussein. You can certainly get a copy of our newsletter. You can, of course, go to our website at radioliberty.com, pull down our newsletters, and, of course, get the documentation free here, because everything is documented, the websites where you can get the books, where you can get the interviews that we've done to give you the background of what we talk about. Remember, our website is www.radioliberty.com. You can listen to our programs there 5 hours a day, live, and then you can go to the archives and listen to those afterwards. You won't get much of anything accomplished, but you will have an opportunity to at least get an overview of what's going on. The information you're not going to get from Rush Limbaugh, Bill O'Reilly, Dan Rather, or Tom Brokaw. So if you'd like, of course, to get a free copy of one of our newsletters, and our latest newsletter, I think, is rather good. It tells you what happened at the secret cabinet meetings that were held in the White House in January and in February of 2001. That is 8 to 9 months before the 9/11 attack. And we simply quote Paul O'Neill, the Secretary of the Treasury, who attended those meetings. I think you'll be fascinated by what he had to say about what the plans were. Were they talking about the danger of China or of North Korea? Well, I'm not going to tell you what they said. Get a copy of the newsletter, and you'll find out. You'll be shocked and, I think, a little horrified when you understand why those boys are dying in Iraq today. And, of course, part of what we're doing is simply to inflame the whole Islamic world, because this is how we're going to get World War III going, turning the whole Islamic world against us. And if the Muslim radicals kill the Americans that they're holding hostage, then we will retaliate and kill their civilians. And this is how you get a war going. You generate hate. And the prophetic writings of Professor Samuel Huntington in his book, The Clash of Civilizations, become a reality. In fact, if you read his book, and we'll be doing some newsletters on that, The Clash of Civilizations by Samuel Huntington, he tells you how to avoid a third world war. And we're doing everything he told us to avoid. And I believe our leaders know exactly what they're doing, or at least the people who guide our leaders know exactly what they're doing, because behind everything going on today are powerful spiritual forces. There really is a devil. There really are demonic forces. There really is a move to create a World War III and claim as many lives as possible. And this is where we're headed today. So remember our telephone number. It's 1-800-544-8927. 1-800-5-HIV-WAR. I hope many of you will want to get my book, The Brotherhood of Darkness, which will explain to you what's really going on in the world and tell you that secret that's been passed down through the ages by the sages of the secret societies. What is it? Well, you'll have to get the book and read it. You can get the book or the Brotherhood of Darkness special, which includes the book, the video, and the audio tape. Just give us a call at 1-800-544-8927 if you're interested in learning more, and then pray for America. Pray for revival. Pray for our leaders and ministers. But please remember to pray for my ministry, Radio Liberty, for our provision and our protection. And so until tomorrow evening, we'll be with you once again. Good night, and may the Lord be with you. Well, this is Dr. Stan here at Radio Liberty, coming to you from the hills overlooking beautiful and picturesque Monterey Bay, and bringing you the news behind the news, the story behind the story. Hoping to convince you that reality is usually scoffed at, illusion is usually king. But in the battle for survival of Western civilization, it's going to be reality, not illusion or delusion, that'll determine what the future will bring. I have to remind you the views that are expressed here are not necessarily those of the owners, management, staff, sponsors, or supporters of this station. They're my views, the views of our guests, the views of our callers, and we welcome your calls from out across America at 1-888-24-LIBERTY or here in the Central Coast of California at 464-8295. But please don't call in until we ask for calls, because we have with us this evening our good friend Joel Skousen, who's the editor of World Affairs Brief. Joel, thank you so much for being with us this evening.
Thank you for having me, Dr. Stan.
Well, if we talked before we went on the air that about this book that was written by Richard Clark. And this book has really caused quite a furor across the nation. It started out on 60 Minutes when Leslie Stahl interviewed Richard Clark, who was very, very critical of President Bush. Richard Clark had been a national security advisor, had been in government for 30 years, and he was really in charge of the area dealing with counterterrorism in the first of all, in the Clinton administration, and then in the second Bush administration. And he, of course, had resigned and then had written a book very critical of the Bush regime, especially their attacking Iraq. And his point, I think, was a very valid one. He said the terrorists attacked the United States. They were centered in Afghanistan. They were certainly had the backing and hospitality of the Taliban, but our enemy was Al-Qaeda and Osama bin Laden. So we attack Afghanistan, if we don't really try to get Osama bin Laden, if we really don't put the troops in there to really take out our enemy, what we do is halt halfway through the battle while Osama bin Laden has escaped, and al-Zawahiri has escaped, and Sheikh Omar has escaped, and Omar Muhammad, I think, is what his name is. They all these names sort of come together. You have a hard time whether it's Abu or Omar Muhammad, but I think it was Omar Muhammad, Sheikh Omar. Anyway, he got away. Everybody got away. The Al Qaeda leadership got away, and so then we attack Iraq. And his point was, it's sort of be like President Roosevelt right after the Japanese attacked Pearl Harbor, attacking Mexico. why would you attack Mexico? You want to get the Japanese, and the same thing would be true. And his book is really fascinating. And from that point of view, it's very true, but there are some very serious problems with the book. Making all sorts of excuses for the Central Intelligence Agency, and I think we've seen now how the whole shift of the discussion across this country has changed from the really important questions like what did the intelligence agencies, not what the president, but what did the intelligence agencies know, or what was their part in what happened on 9/11? Why were there no planes in the air that morning to intercept the incoming hijacked planes, which they knew were hijacked? Why did Building 6 and 7 go down? Who was involved with shorting the stocks for American Airlines and United Airlines in Europe? They tell us that there was no problems in America. They never tell us about Europe, where they were large amounts of money were made by somebody over there. So we've changed the whole thrust of the discussion from, you know, what really happened on that morning to what the president knew. Have you noticed that, Joel?
Well, it appears, and I haven't read Richard Clark's book, and so I thought that would be interesting to discuss that tonight and have you lead with these points of view. I've always thought, since Richard Clark came out, that his book is part of a major diversion to create a controversy that where really no controversy would exist. But the whole controversy itself, even though it is partially true, that is, it's concentrating on foreknowledge of the, or lack of action, lack of any definitive direction to the intelligence community about taking out Osama bin Laden. His story is so much of a cover-up of the same pattern that occurred during the Clinton administration under his own leadership that it indicates to me that this is, in fact, a major piece of misinformation rather than a true tell-all tale.
Well, he makes a number of points that I find very difficult to believe. He says that the president ordered the CIA to take out Osama bin Laden. In other words, to kill him. I mean, Osama bin Laden had killed a lot of Americans. The CIA is outlawed, prevented by law from killing people. But when there is an exception in the law when the president says it's necessary. So the president says it's necessary. And then he says, but the CIA wouldn't do it.
Now, is he talking about President Clinton?
I'm talking about President Clinton. And President Clinton, according to Clark, had given the order, go ahead and take out al-Qaeda and take out Osama bin Laden. And the CIA would come up with all these excuses why it just couldn't do it. And then the Defense Department was ordered, and they had all the reasons why they couldn't do anything at all.
Now, this doesn't sound, it doesn't ring true, Dr. Stan, especially in light of the Sudan opportunity that... the Clinton administration turned down the offer of the Sudan to offer up Osama bin Laden, who they knew where he was and could have captured him and brought him to the United States, and they refused to take custody. So did he discuss that Sudan situation?
Yes. And
He does,
and he says it just isn't true. He said that they've checked out all the records there, and they find no evidence at all that the Sudan ever offered to turn Osama bin Laden over to the United States. And yet, my understanding is that...
What do you mean evidence? I mean, Sudan itself went public and said that we had Saddam Hussein. I mean, this isn't...
Osama bin Laden.
Some, I mean, yes. This isn't some third party... Ahmed Chalabi leak, that's unverifiable. This is the Sudan itself.
And the Sudanese government actually said, we tried to turn him over to the United States, Osama bin Laden, yeah. And they wouldn't take him.
That's right.
And so why would Richard Clark say that it wasn't true? That really bothered me. And then he, of course, going over the history of the various terrorist attacks, talked about the downing of TW-800, and he said, yes, there were several hundred people who saw the missiles going up, but they were all mistaken. He said, I was at the hangar where they had put together the remnants of wreckage of TW-800, and one of the men there was showing me the wreckage, and he explained that it was really an explosion in the central fuel tank, and it was the falling fuel that was gave the impression of rising rockets. The falling fuel looked like rising rockets, and as it fell to a certain distance, it caught fire, and then it burned up, and that's what it looked like, a rocket. And he said, then I went and I told that to the FBI, that prior to that time thought it was a terrorist attack. And I'm reading that, and I'm saying,
this guy's a liar.
Why don't you comment on the downing of TWA, because that's so important.
You know, Dr. Stan, this is just incredulous. You know, one of the big questions we have to ask, what is the head of counterterrorism doing at the TW-800 site, if in fact it isn't a matter of terrorism, if it was a foregone conclusion that this was anything else? I mean, what was he doing inside the hangar?
That's a good question.
You know, to me, what this says is that Richard Clark really wasn't any counterterrorism expert in the Bush administration. He was a cover-up artist. If he takes credit for this, then he, in fact, is part and parcel of the biggest, maybe JFK and Oklahoma City were bigger cover-ups, more extensive, but this is the most blatant falsified cover-up because of the fact that it was just black is white and white is black, according to the government. I mean, they literally turned hundreds of facts on their heads and did some of the most egregious changes. Let me just review for your audience some of the things that they did. The very day after the airplane went down, they sent special Navy divers down to recover the black boxes. And then they altered those black boxes and then put them down on the seafloor to be discovered again during the search. And in order to keep those Navy divers from telling the truth about what they were leaking, or they, by executive order, President Clinton made this particular unit of Navy divers exempt from the Federal Whistleblower Protection Act, meaning that they had no protection as federal whistleblowers should they try to tell what happened. I mean, this was so egregious when this came out. The FBI, for example, when they interviewed witnesses, one of the witnesses leaked to the press that he saw the form that he had in front of him, and one of the first questions on the FBI list when they were interviewing witnesses was, when did you first see the missile? I mean, this was one of the questions that they were asking everyone because they knew there were missiles out there, and they wanted to find out exactly, you know, when and how and where they saw the missiles go up. Now, if there were no missile, then why would the FBI have that on a printed form that they were doing? For example, they found missile motors were dredged up by one of the salvage ships out there on the Sound, and when the FBI came aboard his salvage ship and showed him, they had pictures of Stinger missile motors, and they said, we're looking for this type of unit. He says, too late, I already dredged one up, and I threw it back overboard because you said you weren't looking for that. And now they wanted it, of course. So there's all kinds of evidence. Let me tell you from a military pilot point of view how I interpret the evidence. One of the things that they used to discredit the evidence of the 150, I guess sometimes they say it's 200. Anyway, there were well over 100 witnesses to a missile. But they saw two or three different kinds of missiles, and so they used that to say, oh, the witnesses are all screwed up. They really can't get their story together. But two witnesses saw a particular smoke trail, which I know to be a drone. And a drone is an old-fashioned World War II cruise missile, and it puts out a big puff of white smoke, and it goes horizontal. This is a target drone. That is, it's a missile that's to be used as a simulated target. The two witnesses on further away on Long Island who saw this particular missile, it wasn't going up toward the airplane. It was going straight and level horizontal over Long Island with a big white smoke trail. That was a BQM drone. I fired missiles at them on several occasions. I know what that signature like. That was not the red or orange smoke trail of a vertical missile. All of the other people saw one or two missiles with either red or orange smoke trail. And that could be either of the Strela variety of shoulder fired. It could be a Tomahawk missile. It could be a Stinger missile, but most likely it is a Navy missile that is either shot from a submarine or a surface ship. Now, here's what I believe happened, and that's why I think that this was, in fact, a naval accident. They were in the cover-up mode, and once they'd started to cover up, they continued on with it. When a drone, there was a missile shoot going on in that warning area, which is right off Long Island. There were four or five fast Navy attack vessels in the area. The radar signature showed made a very quick exit as soon as that. They didn't stick around to help find survivors. They just exited the area. That means they had orders to do so. But this was typical of a missile exercise. When you have a BQM drone fired off from one of the local air bases in either Connecticut or on Long Island, it's going across the island, heading for the warning area, and it happens to cross under the path of TW-800. Now, in the Navy, you know, and having shot missiles myself, I know when you're dealing with radar missiles, it's very easy for those missiles to do what we call switch lock. That means they're locked on a target, and it's moving across, and all of a sudden that target's path intersects another target that's crossing over at a different altitude, just like TW-800 was. That missile sometimes, which has its own homing radar in it, can look up and see the other target and think that the one it was tracking did a 90-degree turn or a 45 or an 80-degree turn and start tracking the other target, especially if it's a larger target, like a big Boeing aircraft. I think that's what happened, and that's why the missiles switch-locked and went on and took out TW-800. Well, this has all the evidence of a cover-up, and to go to the expense of making a $2 million film showing the fuel tank explosion, and now to add insult to injury to require all the airlines to retrofit all of their fuel tanks with this nitrogen-based system that instead of putting air into the vents, you know, it fills it with nitrogen so that they're essentially explosion-proof. I mean, that's a great deal of expense. Military aircraft use that, some of the larger military aircraft, and to go to that kind of expense over something that was just a fraud of a government cover-up is really adding insult to injury.
Well, this is basically what Pierre Salinger had said shortly after the TW-800 went down, and he has been vilified and criticized, you know, by everyone. In fact, as I remember, and I could be mistaken, but as I remember, Richard Clark even mentioned that and how he had sort of self-destroyed coming up with this foolish idea. And yet, is it a foolish idea? There were actually well over 200 people who saw those missiles going up, and when they had the NTSB hearings, they did not invite any of them to the hearings. They simply had a government official tell what the witnesses had seen, and he sat there and lied. Have you seen Jack Castle's excellent film, Silence, where he actually has the witnesses they talk about, and then you hear the government official lying in front of the cameras saying, well, this is what Mr. So-and-so said, and then they go to Mr. So-and-so who says, I didn't say that at all. Here's what I saw.
Yes.
That's a wonderful film.
Well, you know, what's interesting here is there have been several leaks. Some of the witnesses have not kept silent, even though some of them told that they were threatened. Others were paid up to $2,000 to keep silent. But most of the people were threatened on the caution of national security. They never discussed this with anyone, what they think they saw. In addition, there was the issue of the misguided facts that came from one of the drone manufacturers in California. The FBI apparently had sent them a fax asking them if a certain drone that had been recovered from the water was one of theirs, and they faxed back to a telephone number that was one number different. One of the digits was erroneous, and it went to a private office, and the fax said, you know, no, this BQM drone is not one of ours. It belongs to McDonnell Douglas. And that serial number, you know, matches another manufacturer. So here was an admission that the FBI knew there was a drone wreckage that was recovered, had tried to find out the owner and the provenance of that drone. The manufacturer had gone back in this particular private office, had called the FBI and said, I have a fax here, and, you know, it's addressed to you, and it says such and such. What do you want me to do with it? And he said, you know, send it over, you know, or make a copy of it and send it over, or send over the original and then destroy the original. And he said, well, what if I don't do that? And the FBI then threatened them, you know, that he better do that. But you see, that has come out. There was an actual press story interviewing the businessman who received that fax. So, you know, the government is just simply lying when they say that this was a fuel tank explosion. Why were they investigating, you know, the drone wreckage and the serial numbers on the drone?
Well, that was what was so interesting, is that Richard Clark in his book makes a very big point of the fact that this was obviously simply an explosion in the central fuel tank, and what looked like rising missiles were actually falling fuel. And if anybody believes that, they have to have a very creative imagination. So why would he put in something like that, which to me, at least, was blatantly false?
And then I think it's obvious that Clark is part of a massive disinformation network. He's playing the Democratic card in collusion with the Republican cover-up that's going on here.
But this is obviously, you know, some sort of a CIA operation, because he, of course, is critical of the CIA on one hand, and yet he's very praiseworthy of George Tenet and what a wonderful man he is, and how he was just so concerned about Al-Qaeda. But he just couldn't get the CIA to do anything about them. And I'm reading this, and I'm saying, is anybody questioning what they're reading here? Because so much of the book is so good. And then, of course, he gets into the Oklahoma City bombing and how this is the lone bomber, Timothy McVeigh, and how, of course, we have to be so concerned about the radical right and the militants. But an example of how these militant loners are is the story of Timothy McVeigh. No mention at all of John Doe 2, 3, or 4. No mention at all about Terry Nichols going over to Philippines and, of course, meeting with Ramzi Yousef, the master bomber for the World Trade Center. We'll be back in just a moment with our special guest, Joel Skousen, right here at Radio Liberty. Well, this is Dr. Stan here at Radio Liberty, our guest this evening, Joel Skousen. And so we were just talking about, of course, the fact that Richard Clark, in his book, talks about the Oklahoma City bombing, but ascribes it to the loner, the radical, right-wing, militant extremist, Timothy McVeigh. Would you like to comment on that?
Well, in my mind, there isn't anyone who can claim to be part of the investigation from the government point of view and make these kinds of statements. Just as in, you know, just one brief flashback to the TW-800, if he claims that he was in that hangar and watching the reconstruction process, then he would have also been knowledgeable in the fact that every time a piece of wreckage came up that showed signs of a missile explosion, they took it out of the hangar room where the big mock-up was being placed, and they put it in another room in an adjacent hangar. They continued to take away all the parts, you know, that pertain to any evidence that there was a missile involved. So the big holes in the fuselage that were being built up. Likewise, in Oklahoma City bombing, you know, it's in fact public information that there were multiple bombs in that building. The Oklahoma City television networks had video clips of bomb squads disarming you. I've seen the videos. I've seen the television clips of them working on these other bombs, and yet, you know, they continued to claim that there was only this fertilizer bomb out front. Of course, they did the same thing in Oklahoma City bomb as they did at the World Trade Center. They went and removed all the debris before any forensic study of the crime scene could be done. They especially knew, because I remember that General Ben Parton's analysis had come out that there had to be point charges in at least two or three of those columns in the middle of the building, because the air-coupled fertilizer explosives simply could not have done damage to the building as they proclaimed. It was very interesting to see those photographs initially of the destruction. And you see two or three pillars that are actually physically removed from the building. I mean, steel and asbestos wrap on it, sheetrock that was wrapped around that, and yet there are pillars right next to it. Not only were they not removed, but the sheetrock was still around the steel pillars. Now, what that indicates is that something actually removed the pillars. There's no way that in a massive air-coupled explosive, and the air coupling is very weak in terms of destroying buildings. It blows out windows and things. It doesn't really do the kind of damage to the Murrah building that happened. It doesn't cause the kind of collapse. But in any case, it cannot, I repeat, it cannot selectively strip and remove whole steel pillars and then leave the next one standing with the sheetrock intact. Simply cannot be done. It's against the laws of physics. So there's lots of examples. The seismographs, as you pointed out before on your show, show two distinct explosions almost 10 seconds apart. So this was, once again, a massive cover-up to make sure that nobody knew what was really going on there.
There's a wonderful video we have called Cover Up in Oklahoma City. And there's an interview with a gentleman who was in the building, and he said the whole building began to shake. And so he dived underneath his desk, and then the explosion came from outside and blew in the windows. Well, obviously, the explosions went on inside first and then outside second. Of course, if it had been from the outside, the windows would have blown in first, but that wasn't what happened at all. The whole building began to shake. But you never heard those interviews on Barbara Walters or 60 Minutes.
Well, that's good.
Well, our guest this evening is Joel Skousen. We're talking about this book by Richard Clark, which was, of course, initially built up by, first of all, it was published by a division of CBS. The same people who controlled CBS published the book. Then he's on 60 Minutes, and then Richard Clark testifies before the Congressional Committee, before the 911 Commission that has some senators on it, but it's supposedly it's an independent, it's not a Congressional Committee. They've already had the Congressional investigation when they did that. Why the President insisted on, or the administration insisted on, censoring it, and almost at least half the pages that I checked had something removed from it, and then they took out 28 pages dealing with Saudi Arabia, and then they appointed another commission, and that's the commission that, of course, Dick Clark testified before. And then, as a result of his testimony, then Condoleezza Rice was forced to testify, and then because of that, why the administration was forced to declassify the CIA briefing of August 6th, and now the whole focus of the discussion is shifted away from the really important questions who was it who contacted Willie Brown the night before the attack and said, "Be careful flying tomorrow," or why did the members of the Joint Chiefs of Staff of the Defense Department cancel their flights for the 11th of September on the 10th of September, and that was reported twice by Newsweek magazine. And yet the editor of Newsweek magazine refuses to talk about that. Why was the article in the San Francisco Chronicle dealing with Willie Brown's being notified pulled out of all the other editions of the Chronicle? It was only in the early morning edition. And then why wasn't it up on the Internet? Did somebody give orders to pull it down off the Internet? The four passports that survived. Two passports, according to the staff report of this commission, had survived the crash in Pennsylvania, and of course one passport survived the crash, the fiery inferno at the World Trade Center. And then one of the hijackers, instead of taking his passport with him, he left it in his baggage, and that baggage just didn't get on the plane, so they found it. So now they've got the passports on four of the terrorists, so that we know who four of the terrorists are. At least that's what they want us to believe. How would you like to, could you respond to the story of those four passports? And that, incidentally, is in the staff report of the 911 Commission.
Well, this, of course, is part of the litany of too good to be true evidence. The pristine passports and suicide letters and other things that are conveniently left behind, the flight manuals in the van left in the parking lot, conveniently left behind, the fact that they used their real names getting on the airplanes and paid with credit cards. I mean, this violates every modus operandi of trained terrorists. You simply don't leave things behind like that, and you have co-conspirators drive you to the airport. I mean, nobody who had the kind of training and technique to be able to pull off this, if it were in fact terrorists, which I don't believe it was, I think, yes, they were involved. I think the stewardess, the extensive telephone combination of the American stewardess, Ms. Ong, O-N-G, with her base indicates a lot of details about the terrorists, including the shooting of one of the passengers, and she'd given the seat numbers of where the terrorists were sitting. A lot of specific information, which, by the way, has been covered up generally. But this is just simply, you know, too good to be true to have this significant, high-tech, very detailed time-wise terrorist planning attack and then having to make stupid mistakes like they do. This has all the markings, of course, of a planted evidence. And the same marking showed up in Spain, for example. You had a van, a supposed getaway van, an anonymous call to the press, letting them know where the location of the van is. Why anonymous? I mean, if there had been a terrorist attack and some nice citizen was going to say, hey, you ought to, you know, check out this van that I've just seen parked in front of my house, then why be anonymous of it? I mean, that's got all the signs of a plant, and sure enough, there were detonators inside, and the all-too-familiar tape recording of Islamic verses or something to prove a provenance from Muslim fundamentalists. It's just unbelievable. I'm very concerned that, you know, the press, who is very, very good about pulling apart any story that they really want to, suddenly shows no ability to think critically or to cross-examine evidence when it isn't something sensitive that the government doesn't want revealed or wants to cover up.
Well, I think one of the most interesting things, a little off the subject, but it's in the staff report from the 911 commission report. They know who each of the terrorists was on each plane. Not only that, but they know who the pilot of the plane was. Now, how did they know who the pilot of the plane was? Did they have somebody on board that told them? Did they wire and say, you know, I'm the pilot of this plane? How would they possibly know who the pilots of those planes were and who each one of those terrorists was on each plane? We'll be right back. Well, this is Dr. Stan here at Radio Liberty. Our guest this evening is Joel Skousen. And not only did they know who all the people were, and they name each person on each plane, who the pilots were, but then, of course, we read in Inside Magazine that at least 6 or 8 of these people are alive and well over in the Middle East. Have you looked into that at all?
Yes, and the evidence seems to be very credible. Even more importantly, 8 or 9 of them were either missing or dead prior to the 9/11 attack. Now, this isn't surprising that I would expect, according to normal terrorist procedures, that those that did get on the plane would use aliases or other falsified identification. They certainly wouldn't use their own identification. And yet, you know, our government has systematically denied us the corroboration of evidence that they supposedly have in their possession that could verify their claims of the 19 hijackers. For example, there are surveillance tapes from the security systems at Boston Logan Airport, which certainly would have shown the terrorist as part of the line of passengers getting on the airplane. The government has those in their possession. They have refused to reveal those. They refuse to let anyone see them. They have passenger manifest. Everything that has been made public has had all of the names of the Arab hijackers deleted, if they were there. Why is that deleted? I personally called the airlines to find out, you know, what were the names of the deleted passengers, and they refused to say. They said it was a matter of national security. They've turned all those over to the government, and you have to talk to the government to get access to that information.
In fact, all of the manifests were published up on the Internet, but there were none of the names of the Arab hijackers on the list of passengers that the airlines published, and that seems so strange.
And there was a mismatch between the numbers of persons reported on the aircraft and the numbers of names on the manifest. They were all lacking 5 or 6 names. So there have been many, many anomalies that have occurred throughout this period that the government could easily take into consideration and verify. You know, there is the whole controversy about the Pentagon crash. Of all of the crashes, this is the one that's most controversial, because the physical evidence simply doesn't allow for the government version of events that a Boeing 707 crashed into the wall of the Pentagon. There's an 18-foot hole that was made in the wall before the wall collapsed. The penetration of whatever hit the Pentagon went through three rings of reinforced pillars, concrete structures, walls, brick, very, very heavy construction.
Hold that thought for just a moment here. We'll be right back. Well, this is Dr. Stan, our guest this evening is Joel Skousen, and he was talking about the crash into the Pentagon. And there was an 18-foot wide or 18-foot hole in the Pentagon, hardly large enough for a 757?
That's correct.
And then it went through three layers of reinforced concrete, and of course there's no evidence of the wings there. Could those wings simply have just disintegrated? How could we explain the fact that there is no obvious wreckage of the plane? And even if it went through the inner wall, the length of that plane, I would think at least some of it, the tail would have been sticking out there.
Well, that's right. The way that it angled in, according to all basic accounts, the entire right wing would have been sheared off and left outside the building. And there's only one piece of, there were small pieces of aircraft, green aluminum, it's the primer that's put on aluminum in both commercial and military aviation. And there was this one piece of evidence, the only one that had some American lettering on it, a piece of 4 foot by 2 foot mangled piece of metal. It's interestingly from the wrong side of the aircraft to have survived and been left out on the lawn, but it's sufficiently far away and there's no other large pieces visible that it's suspected of being a piece of planted evidence. The most crucial evidence about the conundrum surrounding this supposed crash is the Pentagon video from the parking lot of the Pentagon. And this is an edited video. The date is wrong on it, which means someone in their editing the day after had other numbers in the editing process that were superimposed on the video film. And that's one of the indications it was edited. But the most striking thing about it is that the explosion begins with a huge white explosion, and then the fireball appears afterwards. Now, that simply cannot and never has happened in an aircraft explosion where you have a white high explosive signature. That's what the white fiery flash means. That's a high explosive signature and then a fuel fire follows after it. We have several witnesses that actually saw the Boeing 757 aircraft of Flight 77. There are also at least two other witnesses that said they saw a small jet. Now, it's my personal feeling that both were present. I also do believe that that which made the penetration on the Pentagon wall was a missile fired from the jet to penetrate and break up that reinforced construction. And the reason I give for that, first of all, is that's the only thing that could explain the high explosive front end, unless there was something packed into the radome of the aircraft, which, of course, would mean something much more than a terrorist event. I personally happen to think that both aircraft were present. There was a smaller jet that was flying nearby and to the right of the Boeing 757. Interestingly enough, the Pentagon parking lot video does not show, even though it's edited, it's sufficiently visible that the aircraft would have had to show in at least one of the frames, and it simply is not there. What is there is what looks like a small fighter aircraft, approximately the size of an F-15 or an A-4M, an aircraft that I flew in the Marine Corps with the hump back. There is a slight humped view in this small little aircraft that you do see in it. Simply could not be an airliner, and I'm an expert in aircraft recognition. That's what all fighter pilots go through in the military. But there is this strange signature of a missile flare underneath this small little aircraft. But my concern is, and why I think the Pentagon video is doctored, is that the smoke trail is not the way that a smoke trail looks when you fire a real missile from an aircraft. In other words, this smoke trail that's in the video simply could not exist with any existing armament that I know of in the military arsenal. But I think what happened is someone who did leak this was obviously an unauthorized leak. The Pentagon didn't want this thing let go. Whoever leaked it probably knew that a missile had been fired into the Pentagon and doctored the video in order to show a missile or to get someone to come to that conclusion. But he didn't do a very good job of doctoring it. It simply is too puffy. You don't have any puffing at all of a white cloud of smoke. It's just a white swoosh, a very rapid fire of smoke, and it doesn't make any puffing at all. So it's there's no swirling around with the smoke that you see in a real missile shoot. So
well, certainly the Pentagon does have the video someplace, and they are holding them back. Wasn't there a video camera across the street at a gas station that would have had the full story of what happened on it?
That's right, and that video would have shown both jets had they been there simultaneously, and the gas station attendant told the press that within 4 or 5 minutes after the crash, the FBI showed up and confiscated his surveillance video. And, of course, the press never asked the question, well, how could the FBI possibly have got to that location or known that that location would have had a video camera within that short of time when the whole world was in chaos about this? How does the FBI have the presence of mind to get there and do that when they don't even have the competency to be able to track these so-called terrorists? In fact, we do know that they were tracking all of the, what I think are straw men terrorists that were taking training at flight schools. If terrorists were in fact flying those airplanes, they didn't get training at Cessna flight schools because they were flunking everything at those flight schools. They simply could not take off or land those airplanes, let alone do the high G maneuvers that those airliners were capable of doing. So if there were terrorists at the controls of those airlines, they got their training on real live airlines sponsored by some other country. And the only reason for going to these flight schools was to establish a false trail to lead people to the conclusion that they got their training here. And there's no possible way that story coincides with the facts on the ground.
Well, the story that we hear about this pilot that came in to the Pentagon, that he was flying very low, it would have been a very, very difficult thing for even a highly trained pilot to have done, wouldn't it?
Well, not really. If there were two jets there, you see, the air traffic controller talked about a 5 or 6G turn. It was such a sharp turn on his radar scope that he said, you know, that's got to be a high-performance military jet. And it probably was. You see, if there were two jets there, in other words, one military jet shadowing the 757, and I think the missile that came off, that jet and that smaller jet is probably the one that made, the hole in the Pentagon, and it certainly would have needed a missile to help penetrate the wall, lacking a great deal of mass. But, you know, an airliner is a very soft structure as military aircraft go. And it doesn't do much damage. It doesn't penetrate a great deal. It ends up in a pretty big heap. Of course, you know, they claim that the fire consumed almost all the metal of the airliner. Interesting enough, almost everything they haul out of the Pentagon ends up being old file cabinets and drawers and desks, things that are made out of metal and metal shapes, but you just don't see a lot of debris of the actual aircraft coming out.
Well, did they ever claim that they actually got any of the bodies out, or the bones or anything like that?
They claim to have made a DNA match to everybody there. Now, this is almost impossible to do. This is as bad as saying that we have the DNA match to Saddam Hussein. Because to make a DNA match, you have to have an original source of DNA. Now, how did you... And we don't have any indication from the relatives of all of these people who are supposedly on the Pentagon flight that they had the FBI come and do a DNA search for the original DNA. And even if you did do a search, it's very, very difficult after a person is no longer in the house to tell if the DNA on a comb or a hair or something belongs to that particular person. And sometimes there isn't any hair. And to think that they have 100% DNA matching also indicates that they have to have made a match to the supposed terrorists that were on that aircraft as well. And where did they get the original DNA to claim to have a DNA match? Do you understand what I'm saying about having the original sample?
Sure, right.
I mean,
there's many unanswered questions, but the question that asked, and I know Stephen Bush is for the family's organization, and when I interviewed him, and somebody had called and raised the question that maybe the plane didn't crash into the Pentagon, his remark was then, where is my wife? So if the plane did not crash into the Pentagon, what happened to that flight?
Well, that is one question I simply do not have the answer to, I will freely admit. Now, some have hypothesized that that airplane simply overflew the Pentagon very close, while and that its overflight was masked by the explosion of the other jet and the missile explosion. I mean, that does tend to draw people's attention. And that it either flew off in another direction or it circled to the right and landed immediately at Reagan National Airport, which is just right next to the Pentagon. Now, if that happened, then what happened to the people? I don't know. You know, I don't necessarily have to know the answer to discuss some of the things that indicate that the Boeing 707 may not have actually crashed into the Pentagon. There certainly are some unanswered questions there that that absolutely preclude it being a Boeing 757, I mean, or at least just simply a Boeing 757 with fuel load.
All right.
That white hot explosion simply cannot be explained.
Now, of course, the other thing that Richard Clark talks about in his book, he gives us the typical line about what happened to the passenger plane in Pennsylvania, and the fact that, of course, it was the courageous passengers who took on the terrorists and let's roll a theme, and you know, then the plane crashes into the ground. But then how do you explain the fact that two of the passports survived and of course, that the debris was strewn over many, many miles? Apparently, one of the engines was a couple of miles away. And some of the debris, I know a friend of mine had done an analysis of this, some of the debris was 6 or 8 miles away from there. So how can this...
Including one of the engines.
Right. So how can this whole thing be explained by the official party line, which is, of course, what Richard Clark put forward in his book?
Well, of course, we have now a big glaring piece of evidence that we have one of the FAA tape recordings from the Cleveland Center Air Traffic Control, and this came courtesy of a leak from a private company that was in the air at the time, being controlled by Cleveland Center, and every aircraft, and normally an operator at an ATC control center, will be controlling 5 to 10 aircraft, depending on his workload and depending on where they're flying. All of those 5 or 10 aircraft can hear the transmissions of Cleveland Center to every other aircraft that's on that same frequency. That's a very important to understand, so that anytime Cleveland was discussing or talking, or any other ATC hub was talking to Flight 77 or Flight 11, there are literally 5 to 10 other aircraft for every one of those hijacked aircraft who heard all the conversations. Do you understand what I'm saying?
Right. But of course, did anybody record those?
Well, it doesn't... One did record them. I mean, we have the transcript now that was leaked from Executive Flight, 576 or something, or 956, who actually gave the transcript of everything that was said by AT Center and Flight 95, and it's dramatic. In my World Affairs brief of last week, I did print that major excerpts from that transcript. And, you know, later when we talk about how people can get the World Affairs brief, I can tell them how they get a sample.
Why don't we tell them right now before we run out of time?
Right.
How can people get the World Affairs brief and get that transcript?
They can go to my website, JoelSkousen.com, that's JoelSkousen, and read about the World Affairs brief. But if they want to call an 877 number. That's a toll-free number. They can ask for the the World Affairs brief of last week on the 9/11 Commission investigation, and that's 877-518-5888. So that's 877-518-5888, and you can get free copies of that 9/11 transcript, and it's just fascinating to read how the pilots of Flight 93 thought that they were transmitting on the intercom to the pilot, passengers, saying, please sit down and remain calm, we have a bomb on board. And Cleveland Center says, repeat, Flight 93 did not hear you. Executive 956 comes on the line and said he had a bomb on board. And ATC asked another airline, is that what you heard? And he says, yes, that's what I heard. He said he had a bomb on board, and there was yelling and screaming. And ATC begins to then investigate, and after a while of not contacting them, he asked this American airliner, 1060, I believe, he said, you know, you should be right near him, a couple of miles away. Do you see Flight 93? And he says, not at this time, I'm searching. He says, ah, yes, there I see him. And he says, and all of a sudden there's a puff of black smoke. There's a pillar of smoke. It looks like there's been an explosion. So he confirms that there was an explosion in the air. Now, there may have been a bomb, but we also know from one of the air traffic controllers they vectored two F-16s to there, and some witnesses on the ground saw missiles launched from those aircraft that took out one of the engines of the airplane. So nothing about the official version matches the reality of these tapes, and now we can understand why the FAA promised to subpoena the FAA tapes, why the FAA has refused to deliver them, because if they contain the kind of information that we've just heard about Flight 93, we would have also heard tape recordings of Flight 11 and Flight 77 and Flight 175, the one that had the modification bulge on the bottom of the aircraft. There could be all kinds of things that dispute the official version if we were to hear these actual pilot transcripts.
What we have really done through the Richard Clark testimony and then Condoleezza Rice testimony and now the declassification of the August 6th memo, the presidential briefing, we've changed the whole thrust of the discussion. And instead of really getting to the things we've been talking about this evening, we're going to be discussing, well, what did the president know and when did he know it? And by so doing, then we'll... committee will run out of time and they won't get a chance to get many of the things we're talking about. Would that be a fair analysis?
Absolutely. It's no way that they could not know from the internet what these major issues are. The fact that they're not pursuing them means this is a cover-up.
And I really think that this is really a matter of major importance because, of course, the 9/11 attack was what got us into the war with Iraq. The American people were not ready to go to war. They needed an incident to justify a preemptive attack on Iraq because that's what this was all about. If you don't have a copy of my March newsletter, you'll certainly want to get one. We'll be back in just a minute to wrap up the program. Well, our guest this evening is Joel Skousen of World Affairs Brief. And again, if you'd like to get the material, it's, you call 877-518-5888. That's 877-518-5888. Or go to joelskousen.com. And Joel, I'm glad you reminded me. I got so involved listening to what we were saying, I forgot to give you an opportunity to get your telephone number and website out there. Well, do you have any parting thoughts? We've got about 2.5 minutes before we have to let you go.
Yes, I just want to remind them if they want that special issue on the 9/11 investigation, what they're not covering, ask for the April 2nd edition of the World Affairs Brief, because the operators there at that number will also have the latest, the April 9th, so if you want the one on 9/11, say, please, the April 2nd issue. Now, one of the big things that I covered in that April 2nd issue, which is most important, that certainly deserves the largest concentration of time on the 9/11 Commission, is the evidence that there were explosions placed in the World Trade Center to actually bring the building down. The aircraft did not, in fact, collapse the buildings. Now, I was initially one of those who was very reluctant to accept any demolition of the building scenarios, because everyone who was proclaiming demolition was trying to say that they had charges, progressive time charges placed all throughout the building. And they brought it down in a timed collapse, and that really isn't true. There was just no way, I believe, that they could have gone through and done the kind of invasive setting of charges throughout hundreds of floors of this building while it's continually occupied 24 hours a day and been able to hide that. But now that we find out that there were big molten pools of metal in the bottom of the building around the 42 main structural pillars, and these pillars are 4 inches thick in terms of the metal thickness, and you know, approximately 3 or 4 feet square, huge pillars, very, very heavy. It is hypothesized that they used thermite melting explosives, and that's a combination of aluminum oxide and or aluminum powder and iron oxide, which provides the oxygen to burn. And this thing literally gets up to 4,500 degrees and will melt metal and of that size in less than 10 minutes. If you melted those major 42 pillars in the center core of that building and removed that support, then it would, in fact, come down from the damaged section on downward. And I think that is, in fact, how these two buildings came down. It's especially odd that the South Tower, which was hit second, came down first, and it wasn't even damaged in the core. There's no way, engineers have told me, that that could possibly happen, that that core should still be standing.
I think even more than that is, why did Building 6 and why did Building 7 come down? There has never been another building that came down the way these buildings came down unless they were victims of demolition.
I do believe that Building 7, because I've seen the video coming down, was the subject of pre-placed charges, a conventional demolition. This was a conventional steel structure. Had it been damaged on one side from the collapse of the building, it would have toppled to that damaged side. It came straight down, and there's no way that that could happen the way that the facts said it. Besides, Larry Silverstein, the owner, said on television, we made the decision to pull the building, and that's code word for demolish it.
Well, why would you do it the very evening of the attack? Why wouldn't you wait a week or 2 weeks or just do it? But why do it that evening? And the only thing is that this whole thing was planned ahead of time. At least
that's
that
right.
Part of it was.
And it couldn't have been these lonely Arab terrorists doing this kind of sophisticated demolition. This had to be an inside job by people who had access.
Amen to that. Well, we're out of time. Joel, thank you. It's always a pleasure having you with us. Thank you so very much for being a guest here on Radio Liberty.
You're very welcome, Dr. Stitt.
Good night. God bless
Good
you.
Night.
Okay, fine. Well, that was Joel Skousen. Hope you enjoyed his program. And then this is the time we have to remind you that Radio Liberty is listener-supported, and we do hope that many of you out there will seriously consider joining the Radio Liberty family of supporters, because that's how we're able to do what we do. We hope that many of you will want to get a copy of my newsletter, my March newsletter. Tells you what happened at the secret cabinet meetings in the held in the White House in January and February of the year 2001. What were they talking about? This was 8 to 9 months before the 9/11 attack. Now, Paul O'Neill attended those meetings. He was Secretary of the Treasury, and in his book, The Price of Loyalty, on page 96, he tells you what took place. You'll be shocked. You'll be horrified. You'll be sickened. And it's all there in the March newsletter. Give us a call at 1-800-544-8927. That's 1-800-5-HIV-WAR. 1-800-544-8927 if you'd like a free copy of our newsletter. Of course, we hope that you'll go to our website at radioliberty.com. You can listen to our program there 5 hours a day. The first hour, there are links to the American Newsnet. That is at 7 o'clock in the morning Pacific, 9 o'clock in the morning Central Time. Then we do a program from 3 to 5 Pacific, 5 to 7 Central Time, and you can listen to our program there, first hour on GCN Live, second hour on RadioLiberty.com, or both hours on GCN Live if you'd like. We're also on shortwave 4 hours a day. All of the information's at our website. Please tell others about our program, because that's how we build up a listening audience. We don't have the facilities, as many people do, for mass mailings. We send our newsletter out to 1,500 people every month. But we need you out there telling others, and that's how we're building up our internet listening audience and our other audiences, people telling people. Feel free to copy our newsletters. You can pull them down off the website. In fact, you can get our March newsletter. It'll be up there probably in another 4 or 5 days. And we give you our permission to copy anything we have produced, our videos, our audio tapes, as long as you're not selling them. Just help us to disseminate the truth, the information people are not getting from other sources. And then we hope many of you out there will decide that you're going to join with us in this effort to educate the American people about what's really going on, about the information they're not going to get from Rush Limbaugh or Bill O'Reilly or Dan Rather or Tom Brokaw. So remember our number again, 1-800-544-8927. Hope many of you will want to get my book, Brotherhood of Darkness, my video, The Iraq, The Untold Story, which explains the wars, all the wars of the last century, and the real reason for the war in Iraq. And it's not simply for oil, although oil plays a part in it, but it's really all about creating a new world order and a new world religion for the destruction of America as we know it. We ask you to pray for America. We ask you to pray for revival for our leaders and ministers. But please remember to pray for my ministry, Radio Liberty, for our provision and protection. And so until tomorrow evening at the same time, when we'll be with you once again, Dr. Stan, good night, and may the Lord be with you.